Any Bitcoiner who is mad that governments are getting involved in Bitcoin was always being unrealistic about what the path of maturation is for a nascent store value asset. The path to becoming the world's preferred store value asset goes through institutions and government. There's no way to become the preferred store value asset without becoming part of how governments and institutions manage their assets and allocate capital. But it also will accelerate the game theory of Bitcoin adoption globally in ways that I think are hard to appreciate at the moment, because every country on earth saw what Trump just put into policy. And every company in the US and globally also saw that. Every wealthy individual also saw that. The Overton window has shifted dramatically here, where it legitimized Bitcoin as an asset. How it's going to go is you're going to get FOMO because you're going to watch the price of Bitcoin go to $1 million. And at some point along the way, you're going to wish you owned some, and then it's going to keep going up without you. And then you're going to say, okay, I should fucking own some.
Greetings and salutations, my fellow plebs. My name is Walker, and this is the Bitcoin Podcast. Bitcoin continues to create new blocks every 10 minutes, and the value of one Bitcoin is still one Bitcoin. If you are listening to this right now, remember, you are still early. Find me on Noster at primal.net/walker and this podcast at primal.net/titcoin. On X, YouTube, and Rumble, just search at Walker America. And find this podcast on X and Instagram at Titcoin Podcast. Head to the show notes for sponsor links. Head to substack.com/@WalkerAmerica to get episodes emailed to you. And head to bitcoinpodcast.net for everything else. Without further ado, let's get into this Bitcoin talk. If you come out of this discussion and spin up a Noster and pub, I would be very pleased. And then I can go ahead and when I blast this out, I can tag you. It'll be a wonderful journey. You know, we're still early to Bitcoin. We are still early to Noster. So
you've got time. I buy it that's the future of social media, but slightly hot take. I feel like my value, the service I provide to people new to Bitcoin is best on Twitter, you know, because people who are deep into Bitcoin go to Noster, and typically, you know, it's in that direction. So, you know, I feel like if I'm going to have any value to help orange pill people, it's probably on Twitter.
I definitely will not disagree with that point as it comes to orange pilling at a large scale. I know of a number of cases on Noster where people had not had any knowledge of Bitcoin prior to just seeing Jack or Edward Snowden post about this new open protocol for social media. They joined it, found out, what are these people talking about? Zapping? They're zapping Bitcoin. What is this? They went down that rabbit hole through that. Now, most of the people, to your point, that have made their way to Noster, the majority are probably already Bitcoiners. But I think we're seeing an increasing number from not just the US, but like around the world, who are not Bitcoiners, come on Noster, realize, wow, this Bitcoin Lightning Network thing is kind of cool, and then start going down that path. But you also, and this is like, correct me if I'm wrong here, in terms of orange pilling normies, I seem to remember when you doxed yourself and were like, I'm going to start going full blast on like LinkedIn under my own name. Am I remembering that correctly? That's kind of how that went down?
So that was about 2.5 years ago. I decided that I should come out from Croesus, which was my NIM, and put a face to the account, and use my name. And the thought there was, well, it was kind of twofold. It was one, I think it's more effective, to reach people, as a person, you know, in Bitcoin culture, it's fine to be a NIM, but I think you build trust with, pre-coiners faster if you're a person. And the other part was, I felt that there was a moment in time there, an opportunity to start something in Bitcoin, which I ended up doing, and that I was going to need to be a person to do that. So that was kind of the twofold logic there.
Yeah. I mean, I remember thinking like, oh, that's like very brave of you to go on LinkedIn and do this, because I have to imagine, I don't even know if I still have a LinkedIn account, but I have to imagine it's kind of like Facebook or Instagram, where people are like, it's very anti-Bitcoin. Is that the yeah. vibe you get? Because like I started an Instagram account for this this podcast, and like I'll just see some of the comments on there. I've not made a plunge and created a Facebook account for it yet. I don't think I can bring myself to do that. But like you realize how much, even on X, the algorithm puts you in a bit of a bubble where you're kind of just talking to Bitcoiners. People are agreeing with you. You think that all this FUD must be behind us. Like we must have educated everyone, right? And then you realize, oh God, no. The vast majority of people have no idea what's going on. It's kind of like, it's good to remind yourself.
Yeah, I completely agree. I tried posting on LinkedIn for a while and found it too painful, really, and sort of stopped using the platform. And I, you know, I don't really understand how the inner workings of it. At this point, I've spent so much time on Twitter, I feel like I understand it pretty well. And LinkedIn is just so full of shit, basically, too.
It really is. Like, I feel like it's something that people feel like they need to do. Like, it's like hyper fiat. You know, it's just like, people getting social credit credentialism scores and trying to boast about their various accomplishments, which like is fine to be proud of those. But like, I love the memes that you'll see on Twitter about, you know, like, basically like, okay, you know, my 4-year-old son like broke their leg today. Here's what that taught me about corporate finance. You know, just like, what are we even talking about here? But man, stoked to have you on the show. A lot of stuff going on right now that I wanted to dig into with you. Can we start out though, like for people who do not know you, can you just give a little bit of a, who are you? How did you get here today? What brought you down this path?
Yeah. Okay. The quick version. Yeah, so I guess my background is I'm a yuppie elite. I was a management consultant at one of the best firms, Bain & Company. Went and got my MBA at Stanford, one of the best business schools. Learned business, learned finance, learned money through these like blue chip environments, and it was all Keynesian, no mention of Austrian economics ever, maybe as the butt of a joke. I was deeply steeped in that. At business school, I got interested in Ethereum because I heard it about it in a few places at Stanford. And then I kind of stumbled down the Ethereum path, into altcoins more broadly, totally bypassing Bitcoin. And this was 2016. Thought I was really onto something in 2017 when that thesis was working great. And then I got my ass handed to me in 2018 in the bear market there that hammered everything that wasn't Bitcoin. And that forced me to go figure out, okay, shit. Well, taking a step back, I had started an altcoin hedge fund in 2017. And pretty much at the top. And so then I got my ass handed to me, and then my investors were along for the ride. So it was brutal. It was an absolutely brutal year and a half there. And I had to figure out like, what was I missing? Why was I wrong about altcoins? Why was Bitcoin doing better? What's here that I'm wrong about? And that led me to, a series of, really it was a couple books in sequence that I read that cracked it open for me, of The Price of Tomorrow by Jeff Booth. And then Ray Dalio's Changing World Order, which kind of, he doesn't, he's not a Bitcoiner, but it sets the tone for like the world reserve currency changes every 100 years or so. And his sort of conclusion is China is ascendant. And you know, that's fine. That's a fine conclusion because he's not a Bitcoiner. But once you understand Bitcoin, you start to think the internet is ascendant. And so like an internet native world reserve currency makes more sense than anything else. So those two, and then bullish case for Bitcoin, just an article back then. And then finally, I was ready for the Bitcoin standard. And that just undid my MBA. So totally replaced my Stanford MBA in one book. And I hated parts of it. You know, it was really hard to get through. And it, you know, made me, there were a lot of things I had to wrestle with to because my existing worldview was non-compatible with some of the things that SAFE was arguing. And I had to get through that dissonance and realize that he was right, about everything. And that was the beginning of my sort of Bitcoin era and Bitcoin epiphany. And as you know, and probably everyone listening to this, that you know, the first 6 to 12 months that you're in that, you know, new landscape, it's euphoric, it's exhilarating, it's, you know, all you want to do is talk about Bitcoin and how, like, you want to wake up everybody around you. Because it's so obvious now all of a sudden to you. And, you know, I went through that process and everyone in my world started to, you know, ignore me or not want to talk to me or, brush me off or, you know, I was going crazy, right? I was going off the deep end. And, that led me to some of my first, contributions to Bitcoin. So I started using my management consulting toolkit, which is really like crunching numbers in Excel and then turning that into graphics in PowerPoint to present the insights. So I did that for a variety of topics around Bitcoin. And then I wrote Why the Yuppie Elite Dismiss Bitcoin, which is really about my personal journey and the frustrations I was facing with my friend group who continued to ignore Bitcoin. And then, yeah, I've just been contributing to Bitcoin ever since. And yeah, you know, that one resonated with people a lot. And some of the other articles I've written since have also really struck a chord with people for various reasons. And then the other big thing I have been pleased to make a bit of a mark with was I put out my analysis of Bitcoin's full potential valuation. And Michael Saylor kind of took that model and you adopted that framework as his own valuation framework and then added to it and adjusted some assumptions, which is what I wanted people to do with it. So yeah, you probably see Michael Saylor present some of my slides, and that's been really cool too.
It's quite a journey. I'm going to link the Yuppie Elite piece in the show notes here for anyone who hasn't read it. But can you kind of talk through the core thesis there? Because that was like, I read that pretty early in my own Bitcoin journey. And it just kind of really perfectly encapsulated what I was feeling when talking. Like I have a lot of, like all my buddies from college are in, they work for very large banks. They work in some sort of high corporate finance. They are at that level, right? And, you know, and it's like, I love these guys. I wanted them to try and go down this Bitcoin rabbit hole. Some now years later have begun to, but at the time I was just like really frustrated with it. Like, I know these guys are smart. Like, why are they missing this? I read your article and I'm kind of like, ah, okay. So can you walk through kind of that core thesis of that a little bit? Cause I just think it's like, it's really powerful.
Yeah. So I guess the starting point for it was back in 2020, there was a meme going around that was like, you know, people on the IQ bell curve on the far ends, on, you know, the very smart people and the very stupid people are both bullish on Bitcoin. And the people in the middle are like, well, actually, you know, like, here's why it won't work. And that was a popular meme, but it scratches some itch. Like it speaks to some part of the truth, but you know, there I was with my Stanford MBA friends, knowing that they're all like on the super smart extreme end of the spectrum, and none of them are into Bitcoin. They all are the most dismissive people in my life. So, you know, I thought about that for quite a while, and it was like, there's something else here as well. And I kind of realized that the main difference between my Stanford MBA friends and the Bitcoiners that I was interacting with on Twitter was a political rift between them, but it was really like a worldview rift. And it seemed to be more about like what do you believe? Like what sources of information do you trust? What do you think about the, you know, establishment narrative of this or that? And the Bitcoiners all distrust, you know, very disagreeable distrust establishment narratives and what you're told to believe and yada, yada. And my MBA friends kind of just, you know, party line on most topics, certainly political topics. And so it started to crystallize to me that the difference is one of trust, and trust in the system, trust in, you know, what you're being told by authority, and that MBAs, the yuppie elites, as I characterize them, to sort of include like doctors and intelligentsia in general, you know, they're high intelligence but high trust, and then Bitcoiners are high intelligence but very low trust. So they're kind of the two extreme corners of a 2x2 matrix. And I, you know, centered the article around that kind of that insight and teasing out what, you know, what secondary effects come from that. Yeah, like if that is a reasonable representation of the world, what kind of second order conclusions can you draw from that? And it does kind of line up with how I experience Bitcoin and my yuppie elite reactions to Bitcoin. And then, you know, the point of it too is to point out that, you know, the people who have invested so much time and energy in the system are not very quick to question the system and to say, you know what, I've spent my whole career in business, in finance, you know, going to the best schools, learning from the best professors, and all of that's wrong. And these guys on the internet are right. So I think that's a big part of why, you know, the more credentialed a person is in business and finance, the less likely, historically, they have been to consider Bitcoin on its own merits.
I am definitely not a trader. I'm trying to hold my Bitcoin for the long term. And if you're like me, you need to make sure you keep that Bitcoin safe by going to bitbox.swiss/walker and using the promo code Walker for 5% off the fully open source Bitcoin only Bitbox O2 hardware wallet. Then get your Bitcoin off the exchange and into your own self-custody. Bitcoin is chop-solidating, but we have companies, nation states, and a whole lot of plebs like you and me who are stacking harder than ever. So it's going to keep ripping higher. But now is the best time for you to get your security locked down tight with Bitbox. Plus, and I can't emphasize this enough, the Bitbox O2 is just easy as hell to use. Whether you're brand new to Bitcoin, it's your first time setting up a hardware wallet, so you're a little bit nervous, it's understandable, or you are a well-seasoned psychopath, you will have no problem with the Bitbox. And again, it's fully open source and Bitcoin only, but you don't have to trust me, you can go and verify that for yourself on their GitHub. When you go to bitbox.swiss/walker and use the promo code Walker, not only do you get 5% off, but you also help support this podcast. So thank you. It continues to blow my mind that there are Bitcoiners out there who are not yet on Nostr. Seriously, what are you doing? Just like you shouldn't need to ask permission to use your money, you shouldn't need to ask permission to speak freely or have control of your own account, but that is exactly what you are doing if you are still trusting centralized social media platforms. On Nostr, you can't be censored, you can't be banned, and you can't be de-boosted for saying words that Mark Zuckerberg or Elon Musk don't like. And honestly, the vibes are just better on Nostr. Plus, Nostr has Bitcoin payments built in, so when you post a meme, a spicy hot take, or just a photo of your steak, people will zap you Bitcoin to show you they like it and find your content valuable. And if you are a content creator, you can start monetizing your work immediately on Nostr, unlike on X, YouTube, or literally any other centralized platform where you have to hit engagement thresholds and then KYC yourself. You can find me on Nostr by going to primal.net/walker. And you can find this podcast on Nostr at primal.net/titcoin. Primal also has a built-in Bitcoin wallet, so you can literally get zapped by people for your posts, then go use those sats to buy a coffee or do whatever you want, all from the same app. Search for Primal in the App Store, go to primal.net, or choose any of the hundreds of other Nostr apps that are out there, because you can freely switch between any of them anytime you want. So, come join the largest Bitcoin circular economy in the world and start zapping sats on Nostr.
I think it's such a good point. It's kind of like an intellectual sunk cost bias,
mm-hmm.
whereby, okay, I've sunk so much into this, my education, into my worldview, into just my identity as, like, this is who I am. What you're trying to tell me right now completely throws that on its head. It completely flips the script. And, like, to your point, reading, you know, the Bitcoin Standard, it's like, I give you credit for coming from that world and then being able to kind of go through the process of saying, shit, I was probably wrong about a lot of this, not necessarily through a fault of your own, just because this is the pipeline that you came in on. Like, this is the path you were on. It's natural that that pathway would develop these certain characteristics within you, certain worldview characteristics. But to then be able to shake that, like, we clearly see that's not very easy to do. Otherwise, yeah, a lot more people would get Bitcoin, right?
Yeah, it's not very easy to do. And I think, you know, there's an interesting thing there about, like, every Bitcoiner. It's a fun exercise to think about, like, what are the reasons why you are here ahead of most people? Like, I think every single Bitcoiner has a different set of characteristics that make them, you know, differentiated and open to Bitcoin this early. And I think that's different for everybody, but, you know, some of the commonalities are, like, you know, distrusting authority, or, you know, having been exposed to Austrian economics or libertarian ideology, you know, these things help. For example, several early Bitcoiners that I can think of spent some time in Argentina, you know, and saw the currency collapse, fallout from that. Vijay Boyapati has a story of watching his dad have to carry their family net worth in gold on a plane going from India to Australia. And, you know, wow, that's a formative experience. So anyway, I think, you know, each Bitcoiner has their own unique characteristics and circumstances that made it so that it was possible for them to get to Bitcoin this early. For me, I think another element of it was the reason that I made it faster than any of my classmates, as far as I know, is I think the trauma of running a crypto hedge fund and being so wrong that I had to be open to, you know, this crazy possibility that the Bitcoin maximalists were right, and I had to be willing to consider their view. You know, it took me a couple of years to get to that, like, that point of being so wrong that I was willing to consider my worldview being wrong. But, you know, I finally got there. I think about in high school biology class, we did a lab where you basically trick bacteria to take up a gene, like a gene that makes them glow. And the way you do that is by heat shock. So you expose them to hot and then cold and hot and cold. And it's so traumatic for them that they're, like, willing to take up some new DNA to try to survive. And you know, I think there's some similarities there.
Do you think that's the natural progression for everyone who starts out? Because granted, there are some people who come into Bitcoin and just ignore the whole crypto part. Like, I think that's a smaller set, I think. I think most people in some way mess around. Like I know I did before I realized, like, what are you doing? Like, you are not a trader or anything like that. You're just losing here. You're losing in Bitcoin terms. But do you think that's something that, like, does that path, if you do start out with altcoins without a Bitcoin only focus, does that path inevitably lead to Bitcoin only? Just because you end up, like, maybe you win for a while, but finally you just get wrecked. Or are there some people you think, like, the folks in, you know, crypto VCs that are still able to come out on top because they're, you know, basically getting, you know, pre-mined tokens and things like that. Do they just keep the gravy train running for themselves, but more and more of, let's say, retail gets disillusioned?
Yeah. Yeah, great question. I think for, you know, for most people, you have to learn the lesson of why Bitcoin only. And, you know, it's not something that we've grown up around, like, and have the wisdom of some collection of experiences passed on to us. So you know, we're super green and we get tricked by the marketing of, like, you can catch up to where you should have been because you should have gotten Bitcoin earlier, but you didn't, but here's your opportunity. And it's just a siren song that is so tempting. And I think that, you know, there are people out there who have been in altcoins and remain in altcoins, and it's because they've done well. And that's either luck or having an edge. And I think that's, you know, having an edge is what all the insiders have. You know, like if you're at Multicoin Capital and you're, you know, early to Solana and you become a Solana billionaire, which is sort of the story of those guys, then yeah, sure, altcoins make sense because you haven't been burned. And, you know, it works great for you. So why the hell are the maximalists talking about, you know, Bitcoin only? But that's not economically feasible. It's not reality for, it doesn't generalize to the population. Like, most people, 99.9% of people really are better off with Bitcoin only. And that lesson is learned by everybody who goes through altcoins, who doesn't have an edge. And, you know, I think most Bitcoiners today had that experience of, like, going through altcoins, not having an edge, maybe doing well for a while and then underperforming and then ending up with less Bitcoin and then realizing, okay, I'm just going to stick to Bitcoin. And most of the world at the same time, most of the world has yet to arrive to crypto at all, like Bitcoin or crypto. And probably most of the world will go through some painful process as well, the way of pain through altcoins. What does give me hope, though, is that, you know, the more stories there are, the more collective wisdom there is of people's experiences of, you know, passing that on to others of just Bitcoin. I think that starts to become consensus as the, you know, the number of people who share that perspective grows. And then those are the winners, too. You know, like if just stacking sats and holding for 20 years is the winning strategy for, you know, the next 20 years. And so people who do that will be winning along the way, and then they will be increasingly listened to finally, because they have the winning strategy and it's working for them. And then everybody wants to copy that winning strategy. So I think that in 2017, everybody was going to get into altcoins, and then now most people will get into altcoins, and then hopefully 5-10 years from now, the minority of people go through altcoins.
I mean, I certainly hope that that's the case, and I think that that's a fair framework for looking at it. It becomes, as time goes on, it becomes increasingly clear that if you just stack sats and, you know, stay humble, stack sats, hold Bitcoin.
I love that phrase because it's go great. West, young man.
Yeah. It's yeah. Shout out to Odell, because it is a brilliant one. Like, it's just it's a very simple heuristic.
Mm-hmm.
Like, stay humble, stack sats, and that is going to be the best performing strategy over the long haul, unless you are an insider who manages to keep being an insider. And, you know, if you also have no qualms about the moral reprehensibility of knowing that you're screwing over, you know, thousands and thousands of people by dumping your insider tokens on retail. Apparently a lot of people have no qualms about that whatsoever. So I guess that's a different story, but you know, it's interesting too, because we're seeing now and this is just wild to say, at a nation state level, we've seen now the United States government make a distinction very clearly between Bitcoin and crypto. There's a strategic Bitcoin reserve. There's a digital asset stockpile. One of them, they have grounds to add to in a budget neutral way, Bitcoin. The other one, they do not. And they also clarify that they won't sell Bitcoin, but they will potentially sell the digital asset reserve. So I'd love to get your thoughts on this, because I think it's, first of all, it's just like, wow, what a surreal historic time to be alive. This is wild. Where do you fall on this? Good thing, bad thing, inevitable thing? How do you see this playing out?
Yeah, good thing and inevitable thing. Yeah, I definitely saw, I'm of the opinion that any Bitcoiner who is mad that governments are getting involved in Bitcoin was always being unrealistic about what the path of maturation is for a nascent store value asset. You know, the path to becoming the world's preferred store value asset goes through institutions and government. You know, like, there's no way to become the preferred store value asset without becoming a part of how governments and institutions manage their assets and allocate capital. And so, inevitable. I certainly didn't think it would happen this soon in the U.S. I'm a little bit giddy about that. It's kind of unbelievable that El Salvador is the first, and it makes sense why they, you know, with their particular circumstances, why they would be the first adopter, you know, having a leader with huge political mandate, not having their own currency that they print. I think that was very important for, like, you know, you're not losing anything by allowing Bitcoin if you don't control the money printer anyway. So it made sense for them, but the U.S. is, you know, controls the world's reserve currency. So it was a little surprising to have them be kind of the second to adopt Bitcoin as a legitimate part of treasury strategy. That's incredible. Yeah, and it's very much a good thing for Bitcoin overall, because it's inevitable, but it also will accelerate the game theory of Bitcoin adoption globally, and in ways that I think are hard to appreciate at the moment, because every country on earth saw what Trump just put into policy, and every company in the US and globally also saw that, and you know, every wealthy individual also saw that. And so Bitcoin has, the Overton window has shifted dramatically here, where it's not a legitimized Bitcoin as an asset, you know, the legal gray area that it has been plagued by before, of like, you know, where does it fall in terms of regulatory stance, that's gone. You know, this is a legit asset, and it's something that you need to get smart on and consider an allocation to, because if you a few years ago had a 0% allocation to Bitcoin, fine. But now if you have a 0% allocation to Bitcoin, the question is why? Like, why are you excluding that from your portfolio when a balanced portfolio would include that? And so the career risk has flipped for, like, you know, a CIO for a pension or anything like that. Years ago, it would be crazy. It would be career risk to consider Bitcoin as part of your portfolio. And now it's kind of the opposite.
It's essentially at this point seems like a breach of fiduciary duty not to have some exposure to Bitcoin if you're managing other people. Like, to not have exposure to this seems incredibly risky at this point.
Yeah, we're not yet in fiduciary obligation territory, but we are
a little. I went a little.
But we're certainly there. That's a scary phrase for a fund manager.
Yeah.
But we are in like you have egg on your face if you don't know what you're talking about territory, which is, you know, just as good, perhaps even more effective in terms of getting people to warm up to something.
One point I want to just reemphasizes the inevitability point that you mentioned, because I think this part seems to get lost in, and I'm glad that Bitcoiners have very spirited debates about these things and, you know, call each other out and try to point out hypocrisy where we can. Like, that's good. That toxicity keeps us healthy, right? It's a good immune response for the human side of the Bitcoin network that I think we need to keep up. But what I think often gets missed is exactly what you said about, like, this is a natural step, strategic Bitcoin reserve, treasury allocations. This is a natural step and a consequence of Bitcoin winning. Like, if Bitcoin was failing, if Bitcoin sucked, this wouldn't be happening. It's happening because Bitcoin is winning, because Bitcoin is succeeding, because it is becoming too obvious to ignore that you need Bitcoin. And I think that people, it's not a question of, should the government or should not the government hold this from a Bitcoiner's, you know, perspective. It's just the government was always going to do this, and every government will do this if Bitcoin was going to win. Bitcoin is winning, so you should expect this. Like, winning feels a little weird, maybe. It feels like, you know, the people we're fighting, you know, we were fighting against, now they're going to be holding it too. But, like, it's Bitcoin's money for enemies, right? That's kind of the whole thing. It's money. It doesn't care who you are, if you're a government, if you're a corporation, if you're an individual. Everyone's free to use the Bitcoin network. And it's like, if we don't want that part to go away of Bitcoin. That's kind of like a big deal about Bitcoin. It's, you know, it's an amazing thing. So I appreciate you mentioning that, because I think it's easy to get lost in the sauce a little bit.
Yeah. It's, I think about the hipsters a little bit here, like, you know, 10 years ago, hipster culture was big 15 years ago. And part of the joke there is, like, you know, hipsters like stuff before it's cool, right? And then once something becomes mainstream or big, like, you if you're a hipster, you have to stop liking it, because too many people like it, and you have to stay ahead of everybody. And that's sort of going to have to, that's part of winning here is, guess what? The entire world is going to start liking Bitcoin, and that's the cost of winning, is your amazing little hipster world is going to go fully mainstream. And that'll kind of be sad, you know, like Bitcoin Twitter will eventually become, mainstream and like less edgy and less interesting. And then it'll stop existing, you know, far enough down the road. But that, you know, in exchange for that, early Bitcoiners get rich. So I think that's the cost you have to be prepared to pay, and it's the cost of winning.
Do you think does the strategic Bitcoin reserve mark sort of a demarcation, an inflection point in terms of, I mean, it's El Salvador was one thing, right? And I think that's amazing. And I've been back there a number of times now, most recently in January, and it's amazing to see how that country is developing. El Salvador and the United States are very different. The United States is the global superpower, one of the global superpowers. Is this kind of the mark between, if you were buying Bitcoin before and around this point, you're kind of one of the early adopters. After this, are you late majority? Kind of, where do you think we're at on that adoption curve? And does this mark a specific inflection point?
Yeah. So this is one of the first pieces of analysis I did, for Bitcoin. And, we're way, way earlier than people typically think. Because it doesn't feel possible that we can still be this early, but we are. There's 4 million addresses on chain that have 0.1 or more Bitcoin in them. So that's, you know, that's a significant amount of savings, right? Like you've adopted Bitcoin. Let's say you've adopted Bitcoin. If you have, I guess that's $8,000, in an address you control on chain. And then, you know, round that up for people who have Bitcoin on exchanges. And, you know, like there is the question of, have you truly adopted Bitcoin if you have left your Bitcoin on exchange, or like it's just in MicroStrategy or an ETF. But sure, let's round up, call it 10 or 20 million people have some significant savings in Bitcoin. They get it. But there's 8 billion people in the world. So you're still talking about, let's say 0.2% of the world has adopted Bitcoin at this point in time, at that threshold that we've outlined. And that's super different from some of the numbers you see where, you know, you'll see the number of like, oh, there's 200 million people have adopted Bitcoin, but not really. What they're actually talking about is how many people have like ever been a user of Coinbase and any other crypto exchange, and you know, maybe had $5 on Coinbase, and you know, that's everybody. That's everybody in the US. That's all my yuppie elite friends. They all have some tiny stash of crypto that they don't understand, and you know, they're hoping that it's a lottery ticket. But that's not adoption of Bitcoin. So a true adoption of Bitcoin, people who get it and have shifted a material amount of savings into Bitcoin, is something like 20 million, which is, you know, 0.2% of the world. And in the classic bell curve of technology adopters, the first 2.5% is the innovators. That's the first category. 2.5%, we're 0.2% into that, you know, by my math. So we're still in the very early stages of innovators, even though it feels like we're like crossing the chasm into, you know, from early adopters into early majority. But we're not, we're way before that. We're still in innovators. And you know, I think that people get excited about like, try to like inflate those numbers about how many people have adopted Bitcoin because the industry, the crypto industry more broadly, wants to, you know, be taken seriously and look big. But you know, from a Bitcoin perspective, it doesn't do us any good to inflate those numbers, because it's better to look at the reality and realize it's a lot earlier than people typically think. Because, you know, when you get that appropriate perspective, you realize, oh shit, like 99.8% of the world is still behind me. And that means that I can be stacking sats before all these people show up and bid up the price of Bitcoin. So yeah, that's my perspective on how early we are. It's way, way earlier than people typically acknowledge.
I think that's such a, it's such a hard thing to wrap your mind around, even speaking personally and as somebody who has put a lot of time into this, so much time that I had to start a podcast about it, you know? But this idea that like I started stacking modestly in 2020 and, you know, started that journey down the rabbit hole, I'm still going on that journey. But at that point, you know, you see, I think it's very easy to look relative to the other people that you look up to, or that you're, you know, you see people that have been in since 2000, you know, a few from 2010, 11, 12, 13, and you're like, oh my God, how can I possibly be early when these guys were buying Bitcoin for, you know, a few dollars? Like that's, you know, I'm still earlier than some, but I can't be that early. But when you look at it from the global perspective, again, if we're in that Bitcoin echo chamber of like, these are the people you're seeing, this is what you're inundated with all the time, it's easy to forget that the overwhelming, vast, almost, you know, like a rounding error of people own Bitcoin at this point.
Yeah. Yes.
Like that's basically what it comes down to, right? Like,
yeah.
Which is just kind of like, it's a very heartening thing, or it should be, for anyone like who stumbles across this and does not yet have Bitcoin. Like, you hear those numbers and it's like, oh, wow, I'm still really early. But then it becomes a question of like, holy shit, if, you know, whatever we're at right now, 80, low 80 some thousand petrodollars, if that's really early, what does it look like when you actually get to that 2.5% of the end of the innovator phase and then the early adopter? Like what does that actually look like for people? I think the numbers start to get really hard to wrap your head around.
Yeah. Millions is what that starts to look like. I love this topic. It's one of my favorite topics in Bitcoin because I've written a couple articles about this to try to like hit on this theme, and the overarching thing that always pops up for me is the trajectory of the American West. And you asked like where are we in terms of demarcation right now? We're somewhere around the California Gold Rush, like 1849 for Bitcoin. The Louisiana Purchase happened in 1803, suddenly opens up the West for westward expansion, and then Manifest Destiny sort of becomes the prevailing theme for the next 100 years for the US. And at first it was mountain men exploring, and there was absolutely no infrastructure. And then the mountain men start to make like the very earliest infrastructure, trading posts and sort of trails. And that's like the cypherpunks, the super OG Bitcoiners who started Kraken and other companies like that. And that early infrastructure allows for like early settlers to start moving across the country on the Oregon Trail and then the California Trail. And the first few years of the Oregon Trail, if you got to Oregon, you were gifted 640 acres for every married couple, of like prime farmland. And then a few years later, that was cut to 320. And then a few years later, it was cut to 160. And then they ended the program a few years after that. You had to buy your land after that. And it's just a perfect analog for, you know, the experience of being early to Bitcoin, and then a little less early to Bitcoin. You know, the first pioneers to Oregon, like half of them died. So you were taking a lot of risk. And if you got there, you got this, you know, huge reward. And then as time goes by, the frontier becomes de-risked little by little as infrastructure builds out. And, you know, more and more, it becomes accessible to more and more people. And that means prices get bid up for land. And that's the story of the American West sort of developing as a frontier. And we're living through, I think, an analogous frontier development with Bitcoin as the digital frontier, digital real estate that is, cheap still, but it was cheaper in the past. But I think, you know, people now who are in the 0.2% of adopters who have arrived already on the frontier will look back on this as the golden age when you could buy a ranch for cheap, you know, in Bitcoin equivalent terms. You can get to a whole coin, you know, like that's possible still, and it's probably not very accessible in a, you know, 5-10 years. It's probably unthinkable for most people.
I love the idea that in Oregon they literally had like a halving schedule.
Yes.
Of land allocation. That's just kind of, that really is a perfect example there. And yeah, it is. I mean, I think the sentiment I've seen out there right now, and like I get this because I haven't been in Bitcoin that long, but I remember Bitcoin after buying all the way to the 69K top, Bitcoin crashing down to like 16K, I think is where it bottomed out. Like that was rough.
It's very painful. Yeah.
It was extremely painful. Like I was feeling like a genius feeling, and then all of a sudden I'm like, I'm a big dum-dum. You have those thoughts for a second, and then you remember what you know, and you reorient yourself and you look at it as an opportunity. But for people who are maybe just getting into Bitcoin, you know, right now, like we're minting new class of 2025 Bitcoiners, right? has been a, from a news perspective, it's been a very positive start if you're, you know, from an NGU, you know, what should be bullish news perspective. But from a price action perspective and for measuring in fiat petrodollars, it's perhaps been quite disappointing. And so I'm curious, do you see, like, given everything you just said, given how early we are, given the inevitability of this nation state adoption that we're seeing, given the fact that there's 21 million Bitcoin and we can't print more, and there's what, 55 million millionaires, like in the US alone, yeah. I think, or no, not in the US
growing,
alone.
Yeah.
Globally, I think 55 yeah. million US, maybe like 23 or something. So given all that, do you just view this as like a massive asymmetric information problem where it's just people, majority of people still just don't know what's going on?
Yes.
And like, is that where we're at right now?
Yeah. That's exactly how I would describe it. Bitcoin is just a massive information asymmetry. It's an understanding asymmetry. And it's hard to get over that. You know, that's that whole worldview stuff. It's hard to really consider this radically inverted worldview from what, you know, everyone's accustomed to with you need 2% inflation sort of perspective. So right now, to me, in Bitcoin right now feels like it did in Q3 2020. And that was, you know, I had just gotten very active contributing to Bitcoin, was writing stuff and putting out a lot of analysis. That was the time when Michael Saylor suddenly popped up on the scene. My first awareness of it was he suddenly was following me on Twitter, and I was like, who's this guy? He was doing his homework and getting, you know, plugged into Bitcoin Twitter, which is, you know, a badass way to approach it, by the way. He was just like lurking and learning about Bitcoin as it, you know, he probably has some, you know, hidden a non account that he was doing his learning with. But and you know, we had the halving 6 months before that, and COVID hit, and they printed a bunch of money, everyone was at home, and the price of Bitcoin was still 9K. And it was just so obvious that there was just a delay between reality and market price. And that we were about to go a lot higher. And everybody in, you know, in all the Bitcoin maximalists seemed to, there was an energy around that at that time where it was like very clear that we were about to take off because the world had changed. You know, we had gone from not having any company buying Bitcoin, to suddenly MicroStrategy incorporating it as part of, you know, going to a Bitcoin standard. And in large part because Saylor read the Bitcoin standard and as he said, it was a good book, you know, totally bet his company that he spent his life's work on this good book and the thesis of it. And you know, that was, compare that time period and what was going on in that moment versus 2017 when the price was first at 9K. And there was total lack of clarity. Bitcoin Cash was trying to rip apart Bitcoin. There was no corporate adoption. And that next halving had not yet occurred yet. So, so 2020, Q3 2020 felt like it's just a matter of time until the market price is in the new reality. And that's an information and understanding asymmetry that we are privy to. And 99.8% of the world, then 99.95% of the world, do not understand. So it feels like that right now because of the strategic Bitcoin reserve and what that will do geopolitically and in terms of game theory for accumulating Bitcoin all over the world. just a matter of time now for another big leg up.
Just going off of that kind of geopolitical game theory, how do you see this playing out? Like, what is your thesis? Do we, as you correctly said earlier, the president of the United States, Donald Trump, just issued an executive order saying that they're going to stock, you know, have a strategic Bitcoin reserve. They're going to look at budget neutral ways of getting more. You said this is going to the desk of every world leader. This is going to every investment manager. This is going to every wealthy person. A lot of us plebs also read this, how quickly do things start to move? Are there conversations happening, you think, in kind of, you know, in other equivalents of Oval Offices around the world right now, where people are saying, hold on, the U.S. is doing something here. Do we need to be doing something right now too? Like, is that what you think? Like, is there some scrambling happening at this moment?
Yeah, I think so. I think there's probably quite a few countries who have had their eye on Bitcoin, but haven't felt a sense of urgency. And now there's probably some urgency. And the way I've thought about like nation state adoption is, I think RFK made this point at Miami 2 years ago. No, it was in Nashville. He spoke in Miami and then he added these points in Nashville. But he pointed out that the U.S. has 19% of the world's gold. And if the U.S. wants to match that, you know, that position that they enjoy, being one of the largest, if not the largest holder of gold in the world, with digital gold, well, then they have to accumulate, so what's 20%? 4 million Bitcoin. That's the equivalent. And you better get started, right? Like, that's going to be very hard to find, first of all. And, you know, the price would go through the roof if they started to try to do that. What I took from that point was that this is an opportunity for every country on earth, that, you know, if we're moving into a future state, a digital store of value, neutral reserve currency, monetary regime for the world, this is your opportunity to get a good slice of that pie and better your position versus where you've been on the pecking order in terms of, you know, how much gold you control as a country. And I think that's probably especially relevant and motivating to like Gulf countries, you know, in the Middle East, oil-rich countries who have only become rich in the petrodollar era. And now here's your opportunity to like jump a few pegs in terms of your, you know, geopolitical standing, because you could suddenly become a major player because you own a lot of Bitcoin. That's very appealing, you know. And then there's other countries who are sort of newly rich, like Singapore or you know, a handful of others in the world. And so I think that it's probably very motivating to those players. Like, here's your chance. Here's your chance to enter the digital future with like a disproportionate amount of the world's digital wealth. And so I think that's how I see this playing out, is like that will drive accumulation by sovereign wealth funds quite like quietly behind doors. And it's probably, it is definitely happening already. That these players will be scooping up Bitcoin whenever there's a 25% dip. I think that's kind of what we saw last year and are seeing right now too. We went sideways for 8 months last year, and anytime there was a 25% dip, suddenly there was a bunch of buyers who were happy to accumulate. You know, no idea who those buyers are, but it's weird to have that amount of stability in Bitcoin historically. And I think that probably speaks to like accumulation going on from big players. So I see that like continuing to play out. And then, you know, like some of these moves are public. Most of them are not public. You know, I've heard the rumor. I'm pretty sure it's public, but at least I've heard the rumor that Abu Dhabi is like accumulating Bitcoin and adding it to their sovereign wealth fund. You know, who does that inspire? You know, so now you've got El Salvador, Bhutan, Abu Dhabi. Who's like, shit, I'm not going to get left out of that. And they're going to, you know, be the ones to announce next year that they quietly accumulated 100,000 Bitcoin. We'll see.
Yeah, and I mean, I think your point about like nations that are perhaps lower on the totem pole right now, geopolitically, seeing this as an opportunity to quickly elevate their status, especially if they're nations where, depending on the political power structure, they're able to move more quickly than somewhere like the United States, you know, can't move super quickly. I mean, again, I'm surprised and impressed with how quickly this Strategic Reserve Executive Order came out. But, you know, the executive order was probably never going to be, we're going to smash by, you know, $1 trillion worth of Bitcoin tomorrow, just because that's, you know, that's going to need to go through Congress, like just in a nation like the U.S. Now, not all nations function that way. And especially if you're, you know, like a Gulf country monarchy, you can certainly move a heck of a lot faster and deploy capital very quickly at your discretion. And, you know, just make the call. Like, so it'll be really interesting to see. It feels like this next year and couple of years is just going to be kind of wild. And we're at this weird calm before the storm place where Bitcoin's chilling down in the 80K, you know, 80K range. I don't know. Maybe it'll stay there for a while. It doesn't feel like it's going to stay there for that long. And maybe we dump back to 58K. Who knows? Maybe the prophecy will be fulfilled one more time before we go up from there. I would, as much as that would be painful, I would also kind of love that because the 58K meme is just so strong. I don't know. I don't know if we end up going there.
Yeah, I agree. There's a lot of support at 70K because we have spent collectively like close to a year there between the tops in 2021 and then pretty much all of last year. There's not a lot of downside from here, I think, until from like a, you know, a game theory of markets perspective, people are like, well, there's a lot of support here, so I'm going to buy. You know, we may have already even hit that by getting into the high 70s. It feels like a matter of time. It feels like a matter of time right now. And I think we will look back on my impulse buys on Cash App in 2020, in the summer in Q3, where I was just like getting rid of all of my dollars, the whatever dollars I had remaining, buying $100 worth of Bitcoin at a time, and getting over a million sats for that. And, you know, I remember being like, this is just ridiculous. I shouldn't be getting this much Bitcoin for $100. And I think that folks who are stacking sats right now will probably look back on those buys the way I look back on summer 2020.
Yeah, Bitcoin is always feels expensive in the moment and then really, really cheap in retrospect.
Mm-hmm.
At least over a long enough time frame. Like, you know, it felt very cheap at 16K and very, you know, after crashing from 69K, but that's a short time frame, right? But I'm curious too, because okay, nation states kind of aside, going back to Sailor, there, I know you had a thread about this recently about the strike, the STRK, and what's kind of going on there. And this feels like this news, I mean, it made the rounds in Bitcoin Twitter. I feel like a lot of what Sailor is doing is, even as much as he's on CNBC and everything else, again, we're still very early, and it feels like a lot of the market hasn't really digested this. Can you kind of walk through what's going on with that and what it means, why it matters in a larger scale?
Yes. I think it's the most interesting story going on in global finance and certainly in public companies right now. MicroStrategy has now figured out a new and better way to source money from the bond market and convert that value into Bitcoin. That's the net of it. And what they've done is, you know, they've been issuing convertible notes, and that's a discrete process for each individual convertible note. You draft up the document, the proposal, you send it out to the market, you gauge demand, you set the pricing, you then sell to buyers, and then, you know, you collect all that money, and then you close the round, and then you would announce to shareholders what all the details that have happened. And it's a process, and it takes weeks or months to do each individual one. And now they came up with this Strike, STRK, preferred stock offering that is basically a repackaging of a convertible note structure that is perpetual and uncapped in terms of its upside, which are both improvements on prior convertible notes. And it makes it way easier for Strategy to issue new convertible note debt, basically, and then take that money and buy Bitcoin with it. And so they've said that you know, they've created this program to do $21 billion of preferred stock offering, which is really convertible notes packaged as a stock. And side note, they will not stop at $21 billion. That's just them, you know, having some arbitrary and, of course, meaningful number that they chose as a starting round. And so I think that they will absolutely try to raise as much of that as they can, as fast as they can, as fast as the market will absorb, and buy as much Bitcoin as they can. And if, you know, maybe it takes them a year to get through that $21 billion, moving as fast as they can, and then they'll say, okay, great, we're going to double it, and then they'll just keep doing that. So the reason that it's pretty damn appealing and very interesting is that it's convertible debt that issues a 8% dividend on a face value of $100 per share for STRK. So, and then the value of STRK trades on the market. And right now it's trading below $100. So the actual yield of that to holders is, if you buy it now, you're getting better than 8% annual dividend, because it's $8 per share every year that's issued as a dividend. And if it's trading at $80 right now, shit, now you're getting a 10% yield. And so you have it's debt that pays 10% right now every year in perpetuity until it's exercised or retired. And it includes a call option. So if the stock price of MicroStrategy goes to $1,000 per share, then STRK owners can exercise a call option to convert their STRK into MicroStrategy stock. So it's just upside there, right? Like you have an opportunity to convert to stock if those conditions are met. But until then, you get paid 10% dividend, which is really like interest expense, but it's repackaged as a dividend here every year. And that's pretty irresistible to the bond market, the fixed income market, and also the convertible note aspect of the bond market. So they have no choice, basically. Like if you're in fixed income, this new vehicle becomes so appealing that you have to start incorporating it into how you're allocating, I think. And especially if the price trades down at all. So, you know, right now it's effectively a 10% dividend if you buy now. If the price goes down a bit, maybe it's 12, 15% annual dividend. You can't not buy that if you're managing a fixed income portfolio. And what buying that amounts to is handing over your bond dollars to Sailor to convert into Bitcoin. So Sailor and Strategy has created this it's a pump to pump capital out of the bond market and into Bitcoin, and this is just the latest and greatest improvement on that mechanism that MicroStrategy has been for some time and just keeps getting better at being a pump. And so this is a big upgrade, I think, for Strategy as a pump of capital from the bond market into Bitcoin.
Is this the moment where all of the like dividend hero bros on Twitter are finally like, oh wow, here's a high, you know, a high yield dividend stock. Maybe this whole Bitcoin thing's not so bad. I'll get myself some STRK. Like, is this what finally brings the dividend bros around?
Maybe. I think that this just broadens the appeal of what MicroStrategy was already doing. Like they were issuing convertible notes. I guess you would call them sort of private placement convertible notes, where you'd have to be a big capital allocator on the buy side, I guess, in the debt market to be aware of and have access to their convertible notes in the past. And now anybody can access, can hand over their dollars that they want to get, you know, that they think of as this is my fixed income allocation, and you're going to hand over those dollars in exchange for STRK shares, which pay this incredible dividend. But Sailor is going to take those dollars and buy Bitcoin. And so it just like greatly expands the portion of the bond market that Sailor now has access to entice away from holding U.S. Treasuries and other stupid paper. Now like attract away to a better bond that has all these incredible benefits. And it happens to be powered by Bitcoin.
You know, switching gears a little bit. I love that the name of your blog is Once in a Species, because I think it reminds people of the importance of that. And people should definitely check. It's onceinaspecies.com. Yeah.
Yes.
You should definitely check that out. And, you know, I feel that with everything we've discussed here, like we are so early to this. We also see, like, if you are even paying attention a little bit as a pre-coiner, not a no-coiner, but a pre-coiner, because you'll get Bitcoin eventually. There is so much happening, like all at once. You know, Sailor's been doing his Bitcoin strategy for a while. It's now accelerating. Other companies are jumping on board. The U.S. has a strategic Bitcoin reserve executive order. We're going to see other nation states jump on board, and you know, already have you know, Kingdom of Bhutan, maybe Abu Dhabi, El Salvador. There's a lot happening. How do you? If somebody is looking at all of this and still somehow isn't convinced, how do you convince them that this is a once in a species event? How do you bring somebody about to this? How do you make them realize, like, this is something that really does matter to you, that can help you? It doesn't just help individuals, doesn't just help the OGs, doesn't just help nation states. Like, this helps you and you need to pay attention.
Yeah. I don't think anybody's cracked that question. And, you know, I think that's part of my continuing frustration with the world I come from. Is it's hard to get through to people. I have started saying more recently that, you know, I can't convince you. Only you can convince yourself. I can share with you information, but, you know, you're going to make up your mind. And, you know, that I think that's been a kind of nice attack for myself personally, at least, because people are immediately, you know, they put up their wall and they expect you to convince them. And no, it's not how it's going to go. How it's going to go is you're going to get FOMO because you're going to watch the price of Bitcoin go to $1 million. And at some point along the way, you're going to wish you owned some, and then it's going to keep going up without you. And then you're going to say, okay, I should fucking own some. And that's how it goes for everybody, except, you know, the scale is different. For some people, you know, they thought about it at $1 and then they bought at $10. And, you know, for me, I thought about it in 2013 and missed it. And then I was like, oh, what's this new Ethereum thing? It's supposedly going to be better than Bitcoin. All right, I don't want to miss that. And then I, you know, went through the way of paying through altcoins to end up with the amount of Bitcoin that I have. you know, probably better to avoid that step. But, you know, I think the reality is that the number go up properties of Bitcoin is what convinces people ultimately. And it convinces people by inducing pain, FOMO, cognitive dissonance, you know, doubt, self-questioning, and then finally some degree of either through capitulation or through greed, okay, I'll buy some. And then you end up watching that portion of your portfolio outperform everything else with a ton of volatility along the way. And then people are on Team Bitcoin, and then they start to learn about it in earnest. And then, you know, they make it a bigger portion of their portfolio. So, you know, I think that's just the human nature of it. I don't think there's a great way to convince somebody of Bitcoin. I think that the information that's available out there has gotten better. You know, like before 2018, there wasn't the bullish case for Bitcoin. There wasn't the price of tomorrow. There wasn't the Bitcoin standard. Now we have a bunch more awesome Bitcoin only books. And then, you know, the other information that people are receiving is all this social proofing from Wall Street titans, but also from Trump and government in general now. So, you know, everybody has their like activation barrier, their activation energy that you have to overcome before they're going to finally buy a little bit. And I think that the information out there and the social proofing lowers that threshold little by little, year by year, and until finally, you know, it's low enough that it can be cleared and then people start buying. So, you know, I wish there was a better answer. I wish there was a better way, but I think that's just the reality of this asset. And it's the opportunity still for people who have gotten over that barrier already. You still have time. And I think this is going to be a slow and painful process for the world. I think things speed up, and that's the nature of, you know, the early parts of an S curve, which is what this is. You know, that's what a moving through the bell curve of technology adopters amounts to, an S curve of monetization, and the early portion of that is parabolic, and that's what we're going through. So it will accelerate and continue accelerating for 10, probably 20 years. And then it'll start to slow down into maturation after that. But it'll still be fast for quite a while. So, you know, it's going to be painful for people, and it'll be slow for people to get on board. And all that matters is that every 4 years we onboard some incremental slice of that bell curve of technology adopters. And, you know, then that means we have a positive viral coefficient for the properties of, you know, the value of Bitcoin. And that's all it takes. So, you know, I think it will be slower than people hope. You know, like at any point in the last 16 years, people have thought that a large portion of Bitcoin holders thought that there would be some magical moment in time soon where you'd have the God candle and the world would wake up all at once. And I don't think that's how this goes. I think it's a process of moving through the bell curve slowly.
I love the point that you made just about different people having different activations. And it just made me think of two of my very good friends who had basically kind of brushed off Bitcoin every time I told them about it for a number of years. And then once they saw that like Trump was talking about it, they were like, oh, all right, cool. Yeah, I'm in. And I'm like, oh, all right.
Yeah.
You know, just cool.
Chop
man.
Liver over here, Walker.
Yeah. Okay. You know, I, you know, fine. I'm happy that, you know, like either way, I just wanted you guys to get some exposure. Great. But, you know, I probably should have just showed them this chart from your site, because I think this is, and this is the one you were mentioning earlier in the show that Saylor has really picked up on as well. And I think this one is maybe slightly, this is a little bit older one, just given Bitcoin's market cap, but this is such a powerful, powerful visual to realize, holy shit, like Bitcoin is tiny compared to the global pool of capital that's available. Like, yeah, it's mind blowing.
That's right. And yeah, this chart, was a few years ago that I made this. Bitcoin's now almost 2 trillion, call it 2 trillion, and still 0.2% of the world's assets, which goes hand in hand too with that, you know, 99.8% of the world has not woken up to what Bitcoin is. So it checks out there. But yeah, this was part of the full potential valuation piece that it's kind of the starting point that was missing. And I went through the exercise of trying to figure out like how much value is there in the world sitting in these different buckets and a piece together, through a bunch of different data points, this view. And that's what Saylor, latched onto as like as a great visual for setting the stage, I think, for, you know, how Bitcoin, this tells a story of like how early Bitcoin is, but it also hints at how much capital sits in analog assets. And there's one digital asset on this page, and it's tiny because it's brand new. And the implication there is, well, will some of the analog capital osmotically flow into Bitcoin because it has superior properties? And capital seeks out the best store of value over time once it understands what that is. So yeah, it's been really cool to have Saylor use that, and then build his whole Bitcoin 24 valuation model on top of that, which I'm doing some analysis right now to try to shine a light on like the assumptions and the math that he included in that Excel model, which they put out, which is really deep and really cool. So if people are interested in that, you can find that probably, I don't know how soon you're releasing this episode, Walker, but it might be on my Twitter already. So check that out.
Oh, all right. I'll depending on when I get this out the door, I will link that as well. And I just realized I have multiple Substacks, and I just realized I wasn't subscribed on this one, so I'll have to throw you another to boost you out in there.
Haven't been posting a lot the last year or two, but I will start figuring out how to get that engine going again.
Yeah, it's, you know, I love looking at that visual, like, you know, picture's worth a thousand words, right? And it's such a an incredible thing to look at that and just realize what a little, even at 2 trillion, because obviously those other pools of capital have inflated as well.
Yeah.
In the years since you first created that. But it's like,
there was a wow. There's a visual metaphor from Trace Mayer. I don't know when he started saying this, but he talked about Bitcoin as a blueberry that's infinitely inflatable, and you can and now we're going to be able to hook up the city water main of global capital to the blueberry and start pumping capital into this little blueberry and watch it expand. And I was thinking a little bit about that when I put that, that visual together, cause it does sort of paint that picture.
We are, feel very fortunate to exist at this moment and be aware. And if you are listening to this and you are aware and you have been staying humble, hopefully, and stacking sats, like it's a, you know, good on you. Like you're ahead of 99%+ of the world, which is a wild thing to think about. Jesse, this has been, I want to be conscious of your time here. This has been absolutely fantastic. Where do you want to send people? Anything you want to shill besides the Substack? I'll make sure to link your X account. I'm going to get you on Noster as well, so I can link that as well. But where else do you want to send people?
Follow me on Twitter if you haven't already. That's where I put out any new analysis. Onceinthespecies.com is my blog also. And then we didn't even talk about OnRamp, but if people are interested
you got a couple of minutes, yeah, please. Like,
sure,
we can
do that too. I love getting into the classic Bitcoin stuff. So
I got distracted. I had it on my list. All good. Then, you know, yeah.
All good. Yeah. So I guess for people who aren't aware, OnRamp is a multi-institution custody provider. And multi-institution custody is a variation of multi-sig custody, where in this format, you know, there's three keys, as with most multi-sig setups, but each of the keys are held by three separate institutions, and the end user doesn't have to set up and maintain a key of their own. So in that way, multi-institution custody removes the security and technical requirements of engaging in multi-sig for the end user, and has some other benefits too of making inheritance quite seamless, because there's no treasure map of what to do in the event that you die and where the key's located and all that. Instead, it's an easy legal process of, okay, now there's a new beneficiary for the existing institutional key holders to engage with. So you know, that's the project, the company that I've we launched 2 years ago and have been growing ever since. And yeah, it's a very exciting new part of how Bitcoin custody is evolving. And I think it's a great solution for a lot of the bell curve that is yet to arrive into Bitcoin. And also I think a good idea for a lot of people who have all their eggs in one basket currently. You know, because you can put a portion of your stack in this custody and know that it has different risks, and in my opinion, greatly mitigated risks versus, you know, a DIY multi-sig or even a collaborative custody multi-sig. So that's kind of my overview of what it is and who it appeals to.
No, I love it because I think, like, I am all about optionality for people. What are, you know, give people as many, there's no one size fits all solution for people wanting to own Bitcoin. And just because, you know, you or I or somebody else may want to have a completely, you know, quote, sovereign way of holding things, a lot of people do not care about that. And they want something that is, they can, they know that they're not going to screw up because they don't trust themselves, or they can't even figure out how to, you know, open up a PDF correctly, or they think every spam email is a, and I'm not trying to disparage anyone, but you know, they like every spam email they think is a real thing, and they're, you know, calling the customer support line that's listed there. Like, you need different options for different people. And so I think it's really been cool to see, just in the short time that I've been in Bitcoin, see kind of these different options across the board blossom, from different collaborative, you know, collaborative multi-sig to, I know, like what AnchorWatch is doing, to what you guys at OnRamp are doing. Like, it's cool that there are so many different options popping up for people, and they're each going to appeal to a different subset of users, or to your point, you'd even a very hardcore, you know, I want to hold my own keys type of person. Maybe they want to put some in a collab or a multi-institutional custody specifically for inheritance, so that if something happens, you know, like, it's, I like options, and I think we should have many more of them. So where can folks find that?
Yeah. If you're curious about that model, just want to get the overview of it, check out onrampbitcoin.com. And if you're interested in learning more about it, hit the, you know, schedule a consultation button, and we'd be happy to talk you through it.
Nice. Well, Jesse, I want to thank you again for your time here. This was a blast. Anything else we didn't cover you want to close with, or did we do a pretty good job of running the gamut?
No, yeah, we covered the things I wanted to hit in terms of, like, where I really wanted to talk about, you know, how this feels like middle of 2020, and I think we got that point through. I think it's an exciting point in time where there's a lag between what Bitcoiners know about the world and what the world has realized about Bitcoin.
A great way to put it, and I think a perfect note to end on. Well, Jesse, really, thank you for your time. Hope we can do this in person sometime. That'd be fantastic. But really enjoyed this, and looking forward to seeing where things go in these next few months, years, decades. It's going to be a wild ride.
I agree. Thanks for having me, Walker.
Take care, man.
And that's a wrap on this Bitcoin Talk episode of the Bitcoin Podcast. Remember to subscribe to this podcast wherever you're watching or listening, and share it with your friends, family, and strangers on the internet. Find me on Nostr at primal.net/walker and this podcast at primal.net/titcoin. On X, YouTube, and Rumble, just search at Walker America. And find this podcast on X and Instagram at Titcoin Podcast. Head to the show notes to grab sponsor links. Head to substack.com/@WalkerAmerica to get episodes emailed to you. And head to bitcoinpodcast.net for everything else. Bitcoin is scarce, but podcasts are abundant. So thank you for spending your scarce time listening to the Bitcoin Podcast. Until next time, stay free.